So we have two guests who can enlighten us on perhaps two of the most volatile, interesting areas, or two of the most volatile and interesting neighbors of Russia. So we'll start with Katerina Pishakova. Oh, and I want to say we're going to ask each guest to speak for around 20 minutes. Then we have an ample period for discussion and questions. And then we'll have 15 or 20 minutes for further discussion over drinks and snacks. So Katerina?
Thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to be back. Ithaca is beautiful and in any weather. I'm going to focus on the conflict in Ukraine. Lost in Translation is probably not the most original title, but I think it very much goes to the gist of what I will try to argue today when framing my discussion of the conflict. And I'm going to focus specifically on the conflicting and ambiguous narratives surrounding this conflict, the narratives about the subjects and objects of the conflict, their agency, and also the narratives about the actual territoriality of the conflict. And I will do so because I believe that these ambiguities have direct political implications for the conflict resolution and a potential peace plan. And I will also briefly address the sort of broader geopolitical implications of these ambiguities. I will briefly start by maybe recapping a bit the background, like a very short background on the conflict, and then go into more specific details about what and who and how constitutes the conflict and where we are now at the moment. So going, going back a few years from now, Ukraine, as many other former Soviet republics, had been pursuing what it termed a sort of a multi-vector foreign policy since the early 1990s. So the idea was that it was participant to multiple regional integration schemes, multiple cooperation agreements without necessarily choosing for one specific integration scheme or project. And so Ukraine was part of a number of regional, intra-regional arrangements with the former Soviet republics. It had quite intense cooperation with the European Union, lots of bilateral programs. It was actually one of the major beneficiaries of the U.S. foreign assistance. It was the third biggest recipient of U.S. foreign assistance in the 1990s after Egypt and Israel. So it was huge involvement of all the key Western actors. And this went on up till 2009, when the European Union decided to actually deepen its offer to some of its eastern neighbors. So there was this change of direction in the eastern neighborhood for the European Union that decided to propose a more comprehensive association agreement, the possibility of signing comprehensive association agreements. It mostly ended up being offered to four countries, so Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, and Armenia. And the association agreements also involved a deep, comprehensive free trade agreement. These had to be negotiated. It was a sort of a long, highly bureaucratic process, which not surprisingly, is often the case with the European Union. That's pretty much how it does things. So what happened shortly before the actual crisis erupted in Ukraine was that Ukrainian government at the time successfully finished all the negotiations with the European Union and was expected to sign the association agreement at the summit in Vilnius in November 2013. The problem was, though, that Russia was increasingly seeing these integration schemes as in competition and incompatible with its own plans for regional integration that were supposed to take shape into now operational Eurasian Economic Union. And so it started putting pressure on its neighboring countries to actually withdraw from the association agreements. It was very successful with Armenia. It took about 3 days to convince the Armenians to drop that as early as September 2013, for obvious reasons, because Russia is the major provider of security for Armenia. It took longer with Ukraine, but there were threats of trade sanctions. There were threats of cutting the gas supply that Ukraine was dependent on. And so eventually, 1 week before the summit, the Ukrainian government announced that it was also suspending its involvement with the agreement. It was not going to sign it. Now, going back to the domestic response to this, you all must have followed, have been following this back then in the news. That actually provoked quite a big backlash on the side of Ukrainians, which initially wasn't that that huge. It wasn't. It was concerning a certain a number of, you know, students and young people who were upset about this choice. It sort of was indeed more about, you know, what they saw could have been a better, you know, foreign policy choice for Ukraine, a better trajectory. But then very quickly it evolved into a much bigger domestic issue. And this is something that sometimes gets overlooked maybe in the discussion of the Ukrainian crisis. But the what ended up being 3 months of very intense protests that involved also violence against peaceful protesters was ended up being not so much about the foreign policy choices of Ukraine as about the domestic problems, about the dysfunctionality of the Ukrainian governance system, the need for deep and comprehensive reform, transparent and accountable governance, all these things that Ukrainians perceived the European Union, the cooperation with the European Union could have helped with. And they felt that rapprochement with Russia was probably not going to help this at all, because Russia itself is run pretty much by this, by a similar corrupt and authoritarian regime. So, so the worry was has increasingly become about the issue has increasingly become domestic and increasingly associated, sort of grew into backlash against the government and the president, who was not cooperative, was adopted very violent responses to the protest, as was not willing to negotiate or to open a sort of a broader dialogue with the protesters, and ended up having to flee on February 21st in 2014. Now, what happened after he fled was that very quickly an interim government was formed and an acting president was nominated, obviously coming from the opposition parties, right? Because the president's party was discredited by their support of the president that had to flee. But the problem with that interim government politically was, of course, that it wasn't very representative of the protest movement, because it was still composed of the good and old opposition parties that were in opposition to the president Yanukovych and his party, but they were not necessarily representing the change and the new faces and the new leadership that people thought they were actually fighting for, and that they were expecting the sort of this new revolutionary scenario to bring about. So there was this moment when people were expecting more change and leadership change in Kyiv, and there were a lot of expectation and a lot of political volatility as well. And this is the climate in which, less than a month later, Russia actually annexed the Crimean Peninsula, for obvious strategic reasons, because Crimean Peninsula was home to the Russian Black Sea Fleet. It's the biggest Russian fleet. It doesn't have other access to sea where it could host as big a fleet. So it was leasing this area from Ukraine since Ukraine's independence, and that was always a very thorny issue, because leadership in Kremlin in general, but especially Putin, who wanted to be, you know, a big, strong, self-sustainable leader, obviously wasn't happy about having to negotiate and sort of being a bit at the whim of whoever comes to power to Kyiv. So they ended up just quickly annexing that in March 2018. And this is where things got complicated, because obviously that exposed huge military presence and of Russia, the proximity of Russia and the willingness of Russia to use military means against its members, its neighbors. So what I wanted to do now is to show you this, just to sort of to remind us where we are, this little map, and not particularly nuanced, but helpful for our discussion. So a few footnotes to this map. The orange coloring that that is about percentage of population which speaks Russian natively. This is based on the 2001 census. That is the only census that had that we have, all the Ukraine census. And so obviously, but what we know, although there is no all Ukraine data available, is that the percentage of Ukrainian speakers has in the meantime increased, partly for obvious demographic dynamics, but partly also because the conflict with Russia has politicized the issue of language use. That was a strong sort of rally around the flag effect, including in the eastern and southern part of Ukraine. And so people started consciously choosing to speak in Ukrainian more and more in their daily lives as a response to this situation in their country. Let me highlight once more that this is the graph about self-declared first language. This is not about ethnicity, and this is perfectly in line with the sort of longer Soviet history of Russification in Ukraine and in other Soviet republics, where you actually had to be speaking Russian to access higher education, to access white-collar jobs, to be in leadership positions. So you can't see this from the map, but actually if you break this down a little bit more, you can see that maybe even in darker orange regions, you would have a higher concentration of Russian speakers in the urban areas and then a lower concentration in the rural areas. And actually, the south and east of Ukraine is the more urbanized and more industrial part of Ukraine as a whole. So they kind of it is about proximity to Russia, but not only. It's a sort of a more a longer story behind that. Another thing that I wanted to highlight is it looks as if Crimea and the Donetsk region are sort of have a similar situation, but actually this is where. But they're not, because Crimea actually did have more than half percent, more than 50% of the population of ethnic Russians, and that had to do again with this, with the very peculiar history of Crimea. And it was Ukraine isn't a unitary state, but it was the only autonomous region with a special status and its own parliament. So there was a whole different story around Crimea, and there was there has always been a relatively big support for reunification with Russia, a lot of sort of Russian cultural organizations and things like that. And so, you know, there are obviously problems with the way the peninsula got annexed by Russia, but it's also true that they might have, under different circumstances, they might have had their own Krexit, so to say. I mean, this is where actually there was genuine constituency for either gaining additional autonomy from Ukraine or actually wanting to join Russia. And this is very different for the provinces in the east that are now affected by the conflict. And this is something I wanted to highlight. The orange line here. It's sort of a very approximate divide about how people voted in 2010 election when President Yanukovych got elected. And why it's useful for us here is that, of course, all the regions that you see to the east and south are the ones that voted against the opposition parties they found in the interim government after Yanukovych left. So they probably were not terribly fond of Yanukovych because they were aware of the fact that his government got increasingly authoritarian and corrupt, and the majority, there were anti-Yanukovych protests in all of these regions before the president fled the country. But at the same time, they were not as they were a bit suspicious about the people who got into the interim government, and they were sort of there waiting and trying to see what the real political change was about. So this kind of created a certain sense of vulnerability in those areas, and they're obviously there's a long border with Russia. And what happened right after the annexation of Crimea is that Russia started building up militarily along the whole of that border. So also along the Kharkiv, the border with Kharkiv region, Luhansk, and Donetsk. There was all of a sudden this massive military buildup. And so if you think of it, if you think of the people who live there, you can see from the map that Crimea doesn't have a land connection with Russia. It has only this tiny land connection with Ukraine. And so when you know, people sort of started looking around, they realized Russia may want a land corridor to Crimea, right? So if you lived in the south, in Donetsk and Zaporozhye and Kherson, you would think, well, that's Putin's next move, and who knows, you know, how even how the government would be able to react to any further military aggression. Probably not, because they obviously were no match if Putin wanted to conduct a proper military campaign. Another example, if you were in Kharkiv, which is only 60 kilometers from the Russian border, you knew that you were actually on the direct railway line between Moscow and Crimea. And so again, you would think, that's it, you know, our fate is sealed. And then, you know, with all the tanks there, and the border was basically non-existent, right? It was an open border between Ukraine and Russia. If you were in Odessa, you can't see this from the map, but you're not only bordering on Moldova. You have a huge stretch of the border which borders on Transnistria, which is another breakaway region and a sort of pseudo state that declared its independence from Moldova in the early 1990s. And since then, it has actually had Russian military presence as sort of a kind of Russian peacekeeping forces, so to say. And so again, you would think, well, maybe the land corridor could be with Transnistria. And what the reason why I'm saying this, I mean, none of this obviously came true, and I personally don't think there is much basis for further military action into the Ukrainian territory by Russian forces. But that what I wanted to highlight is this huge sense of vulnerability that was always due to the actual territorial position of some of these provinces and the uncertainty that was obviously inherent in the post-revolutionary political scenario in the country. And so that's why you saw all kinds of anti-Kyiv protests, and it was a really sort of murky situation. Some of it was genuine local response to the new government. A lot of it was fomented by the Russian operatives. In Kharkiv, there was evidence of people just being bussed from across the border, Russians being bussed from across the border into the main square to wave Russian flags and proclaim, you know, come and save us. We're under threat because there was a change of government in Russia. So before I move into the specificity of the current conflict, what I wanted to highlight is this broader vulnerability that is still being perceived in this huge part of Ukraine, and it obviously feeds into certain politics in the rest of Ukraine. Now, this map, on the other hand, is about the actual conflict zone. And I'm not sure how well you can see, but this is I think this is a very interesting bit here. This tiny gray line is the... This is the original border of this so-called self-proclaimed People's Republic. So there were two uprisings, and then people occupied regional administration buildings, and they sort of had a kind of a referendum of their own as well, and they said, we are going to be independent from Ukraine. We are the People's Republics of Donetsk and the People's Republic of Luhansk. And that was the original territory where supposedly these ideas and these movement had traction. What happened was then that the Kyiv government reacted quite forcefully to that and started a military offensive against those separatist groups that they immediately designated as terrorists. And they were very successful in this military campaign. So the orange area on the first map is actually where it shows how much that territory shrank by September 2014, and this is when the first peace deal was being brokered in Minsk. So the infamous Minsk Accords were about that orange territory, that didn't suit Putin and didn't suit the People's Republics, because they no longer had control of the key infrastructure. They had much less territory, and so that's mostly the reason why that was a stillborn peace accord, because the reality of on the ground was not convincing to the separatist groups, and so they continued with the offensive with the help at that point with the very obvious help of the Russian military. And they did manage to expand the territory. So by the time the second the update to the Minsk Accords was signed in February 2015, you can see the territory is much bigger. And you can also see that they didn't try to recapture those original, supposedly more pro-People's Republic's territories, but they clearly followed the Russian border and sort of the rationale of eventually moving towards Crimea and the sort of land corridor to Crimea. So that sort of tells you a bit something about the way the territory got reconfigured. But more broadly speaking, I think what I would argue on the basis of all of this is that the territory of the conflict remains a kind of a moving target in itself. It is a conflict that is not confined to clear boundaries, whether geographic, historical, ethnic, political. It is rather an entity that is in the making through the conflict itself. And this is where the major sort of sense of vulnerability comes from. And that means that at the moment, its boundaries are perceived as arbitrary and movable by both those within and those without. And there's a very important feature of this conflict that I think has far-reaching implications. Now, let me say a few more words about the sort of the subjects and objects of this conflict and their agency very quickly. So as I mentioned, the way Ukrainian government reacted to the uprisings in these two provinces was by announcing an anti-terrorist operation against those separatists, as they are called, and designating the two People Republics as terrorist organizations. And that obviously confirmed their inability of the government to reestablish the control over those territory by political means. It justified the use of military force as opposed to regular police forces. It also implied that the separatist leaders could not be legitimate interlocutors in any sort of peace negotiation. But then, ironically, they are actually the signatories under both peace deals that were signed in Minsk. At the same time, the Ukrainian government refuses to talk about occupation or war, as that would mean the policies of isolation, right? You would need to seal off the border. You would need to first again agree on the border, which, as I mentioned, is a movable border. Both Minsk Accords, they do not specifically spell out where the conflict border is. They say, as will be determined. So that's already, again, very very significant. And this is not what is happening. So these territories that you can see now in orange, they're designated as territories temporarily outside of government's control, which again reinforces the idea of a very transitory and fluid nature of the border between these entities and Ukraine. The border remained very porous, so there's about something like 8 crossing points between these republics and Ukraine, and there's something between 20 and 40,000 people crossing it daily, because Ukraine continues to provide social welfare to these people, but there is no longer the Ukrainian bank network operating. So they just cross to pick up their pensions. Half of the families on one side, half of the families on the other side. It's a very sort of fluid kind of border. They used to be very... all the trade was in place until very recently. There's a new development with the trade blockade. We can talk about it later. But there was full-scale trade between the factories and enterprises on the separatist control areas and the rest of Ukraine. The factories on the in the separatist controlled area were paying taxes to Kiev. So it's sort of a really hybrid and fluid and messy kind of arrangement. So it's not even clear what kind of division the conflict represents. But this refusal to talk about war has also huge impact on the populations that are affected by war. So there is a law about the IDPs, the internally displaced persons, that sort of tries to regulate them and put in place the procedures for registering them and distributing benefits. But since there is no war affected population. So if your house was bombed, there is no way to claim damage. If you live not within the government uncontrolled territories, but on the border, and you're just a victim of occasional shelling or any other sort of harm, there is no way to claim. You don't exist sort of legally or conceptually as someone whose life is directly affected. And so, very briefly, just to show what that means, for example, So this is a recent poll that doesn't include the people who live in the in this people's in, this self-proclaimed people's republics, but and it, the question is how do you perceive the people who live on those territories? Huh? And it's amazing if you look at it that basically a huge majority think of those as being hostages to something. Yeah, they don't see that there is no discursive separation between us and them. Huh? So we are different, and them on the other side of the conflict as represent some other kind of different group. It's like we are the same, but they are hostages to a specific situation. They are hostages because they didn't have the economic means to leave. They are hostages because they they're too old, and so on and so forth. So this is extremely telling because it's only 5% that think these are the traitors, and you know that support the kind of an enemy discourse, enemy against someone that's against us and we're at war with. So this is, I think, very significant. And just to finish up with the discussion of the conflict, you see. So these are some ideas about what, again, from the same polling, what would you expect? Would what kind of solution? What kind of policy would you accept to be able to resolve the conflict? And what I wanted to highlight is the special status thing. So if you look at the Minsk agreements, it's all about how the newly proclaimed people's republics have to have a special status in Ukraine's constitution, because there is already a temporary law on the special status of those republics, and it's deemed as insufficient by both Russia and the leaders of the people's republics, because they say we want a change in the constitution proper of Ukraine that gives us a special status. And the interesting thing, you can't see the breakdown here, but the interesting thing about number one is that if you break it up by regions in Ukraine, so west, center, east, south, the people that live in the part of Donetsk and Luhansk regions that are controlled by the government of Ukraine, they are the ones that are most against the idea of a special status. Because for them, this is like, well, you know, my aunt lives there. What's the special status is about? They are the ones most in favor of going back to the status quo before the war. They want a unitary state. They want this territories reintegrated into Ukraine on the basis of the existing legal framework. They don't see the grounds, or they don't expect any reasons why these have to be all of a sudden sort of a special status territories. And this is, of course, has a huge impact on whether and how this conflict can be taken forward in terms of peaceful resolution. So the implications of all these ambiguities about who is involved in the conflict, who has what kind of agency in this conflict, what are the stakes in this conflict, what is the sort of the necessary and sufficient conditions for resolving this conflict, obviously have huge implications for the possible resolution of the conflict. And so I will conclude by highlighting two more geopolitical issues here. One is, I would argue, this ambiguity is obviously in the interest of Russia, because if Russia cannot get the kind of resolution that it's been brokering all along, so the special status, federalized Ukraine with a special status to these entities, that is fine as well. That works well for Russia too. It figured it can wait and see. You know, the conflict is a huge drain on Ukrainian resources. You know, economic, but also political. The conflict is draining the popularity and the status of the current government and the president. And obviously, because of the hardship, there is a concern that if there is election, the more radical forces are going to come into power, because that's what happens when the socioeconomic situation deteriorates and you have a hot conflict on your territory. So even sort of a protracted conflict of this nature is perfectly fine for Russia, because the idea is to destabilize Ukraine and make sure that it stays as is. And what I would argue, since we're here and we're sort of supposed to talk about the role of the US as well, I think this is, regardless of what is going to be this administration's concrete policy for Russia and Ukraine and the whole region, the ambiguity is already doing a lot of harm. And this is where you can see, Chris mentioned this in his introduction, well, how come there's renewed fighting? How come Russia actually announced it will recognize the passports issued by the People's Republics, and so that people can travel to Russia on those passports and enroll in universities and whatnot? All of this has coincided with the situation where there's no security about which way the US policy is going to go. And so it pushes both sides, not just the Russians, but also the Ukrainians, to up their stakes, to fight for leverage, to push and try and create maybe new realities on the ground, to escalate so that the interest and the attention to the region and the conflict is high, to circulate all sorts of alternative peace plans, which are not necessarily maybe really shared by a broader set of stakeholders. So these are the pitfalls and the risks of the ambiguity in this policy. And this is why the U.S. has the responsibility to actually come up quickly with a very clear indication of where it wants to go in its Russia and Ukraine policy. And we'll stop here.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and to talk about the Baltic states. So every time I have to talk about the Baltic states and to a foreign audience, I like to start with a little insight in the history of the Baltic states in the 20th century. So the Baltic states became independent in 1918, before they were a part of Tsarist Russia. And they were independent between the two world wars. So that's the big difference between the Baltic states and other countries that we know as post-Soviet states. The Baltic states were independent between the First World War and the Second World War. In 1940, they were illegally annexed to the Soviet Union. And then there was a Nazi occupation. And then after the Second World War, they were again occupied and illegally annexed by the Soviet Union. The Baltic states became independent after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And unlike Ukraine or other former Soviet republics, the Baltic states chose a clear pro-Western policy. So very quickly, their main foreign policy goal became joining EU and NATO. And they became members of EU and NATO in 2004. The Baltic states, so in Estonia, Estonians speak Estonian, which is a Finno-Ugric language. Latvians and Lithuanians, so Latvians speak Latvian, Lithuanians speak Lithuanian, and those are Indo-European languages. And of course, then there is an important Russian-speaking minority, especially in Estonia and Latvia, and I will speak about that question later. So after this brief insight into the history of the Baltic states, in 2014, a British journalist, Mike Collier, who is also the editor-in-chief of English language section of Latvian Public Broadcasting, wrote about how, in the light of Ukrainian crisis, his colleagues from the Western media called him very often to ask whether he sees the signs of the Baltic states being the next target of Russian aggression. And so I'm quoting Mike. So on a weekly basis, I'm asked what's going on in Latvian eastern districts. If Latgale, so eastern part of Latvia, is in ferment, if there are Crimea-style militias drilling in secret training camps. The answer is no, there are not, which always elicits a sign of disappointment and mild disbelief from the other side of the line. End of the quote. So the Ukrainian crisis put the Baltic states in a curious and strange situation. For years, they have complained to the EU and NATO allies about Russian meddling in their internal affairs, about cyber attacks against their institutions, about fake news and misinformation campaigns. And often, very often, they have had the feeling that their complaints have not been taken very seriously. And then after the illegal annexation of Crimea, they suddenly found themselves at the spotlight of attention. And so there were different discussions in the West about how the Baltic states are going to become the next target of Russian aggression. For example, the former NATO Secretary General, Andres Frog Rasmussen, warned that the Russian Federation could prepare a hybrid attack in the Baltics in order to test NATO resolve. In late February 2015, British Defense Secretary Michael Fallon stated that Russian President Vladimir Putin is a real and present danger to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And actually, the same month, Lithuania restored a compulsory military service. The European and the US press, though, so over 2014, 2015, discussed if NATO allies would and should be ready to die for Narva, which is a border town in eastern Estonia, mainly inhabited by Russian speakers. So yes, indeed, the Baltic and Ukrainian situations are not without similarities. All three Baltic states, as I said, had formerly been part of the Soviet Union and as well of the Tsarist Empire. And so they could be seen, I'm not saying that they are, but they could be seen in Moscow as the traditional Russian zone of influence. 27-28% of Latvian population and about 26% of Estonian population are ethnic Russians. And this is a recent immigration. So basically, these Russian-speaking minorities, who are not just ethnic Russians, but also Ukrainians, Belarusians, this basically is an the result of migration that took place during the Soviet period. The fate of these communities has been a source of constant tensions between Moscow, Riga, and Tallinn, mostly in the 90s and early 2000s, less these days. In both Latvian and Estonian cases, important numbers of Russian speakers live in the eastern part of the country, so which could eventually lead to a possible repetition of Donbas scenario. And also, at the beginning of Ukrainian crisis, all three republics, not anymore, but at the beginning of the crisis, all three Baltic states were still largely depending on Russian gas. So in the light of raising tensions between Russia and the West, many observers did not exclude the possibility or the capacity of Russia to orchestrate some kind of destabilization also in the Baltic states. At the same time, there are also important differences between Ukrainian situation and the Baltic states. So as I said before, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have been EU and NATO member states since 2004. So there are people who are arguing that Russian Federation would not risk attacking NATO member states, while others insist that Moscow might actually be willing to use Latvia or Estonia as a test case to assess either NATO resolve to defend the Baltic states, actually to see whether Article 5 actually works or not, and secondly, to test its capacity, so NATO's capacity, to successfully face a hybrid warfare. At the same time, we should, when we are talking about Russian-speaking minorities in the Baltic states, I think it's very important to avoid the oversimplification of the situation. So Russian-speaking minorities are not all ethnic Russians. There are also people who are Ukrainians, Belarusians. Also, there's a Polish minority who has been Russified during the Soviet period. And the political views of these groups often, and these groups are not homogeneous. So there are people who live at the countryside, people who live in the capitals, people with higher education, with less education. So we should assume also the political views of these groups are not entirely defined by their ethnicity. According to data from 2012, the absolute majority of Russian speakers in Latvia, so around 66%, consider themselves as patriots of Latvia. At the same time, many of them, around 32%, also identify themselves with Russia. So there are these double identities that does not necessarily exclude each other. According to a very recent, and so the big question is also whether Russian misinformation campaigns about Ukraine or about Latvia or Estonia, Lithuania, do they work and can they be used to instrumentalize these minorities in the Baltic states? So according to a recent 2017 poll in Latvia, Latvian and Russian So ethnic Latvian and Russian-speaking minority, the people from the Russian-speaking minority, their perceptions about Ukrainian and Russian conflict are rather different. So 5% of Latvians and 41% of Russian speakers say to support Russia in the conflict between Ukraine and Russia, while 52% of Latvians and only 7% of Russian speakers support Ukraine. But the interesting part is that almost 36% of Latvians and 40% of Russians living in Latvia, or Russian speakers living in Latvia, insist that they are neutral, that they don't want to pick sides in the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. It's also very interesting, I found, that when it comes to the evaluation of certain ideological statements that Russian mass media have used in their narratives about Ukraine and also about Latvia and other Baltic states, Latvian society seems to be rather united. So, according to these recent data from 2017, when people were asked to evaluate statements such as the existence of Latvian state is a mistake, so there were only 5% who agreed to this statement. Or statement that we have heard in the Russian news that Latvia is a fascist state, again, only 5% of people, both Latvians and Russians, agreed, so 5%. As it was said by Ivars Ijeps, who is a Latvian political and Latvian analyst, and who has worked on these questions, he has evaluated the attitudes of Russian-speaking minority regarding Russia, Crimea, and the conflict, and also their relations with Latvia. So I'm quoting him, "They, the Russian speakers, like Putin, and they support the annexation of Crimea. However, they clearly do not support Russian military invasion in Ukraine, and they do not want anything similar to happen in Latvia." So the question is not just about Russian possibility to the capacity of Russian Federation to somehow manipulate or instrumentalize the Russian-speaking minority. Even if Russian language media are more popular among Latvian Russians, they also can impact ethnic Latvians. More than 90% of people whose native language is Latvian have some knowledge of Russian language. So Russian media are accessible to large numbers also of so-called ethnic Latvians. And such media sources could be and can be used to impact Latvian society's views not only on Putin's domestic and foreign policies, but also on questions such as European integration, the refugee crisis, or LGBT rights. So the question is whether the Baltic states, or European Union in general, should or could somehow restrict the access of its citizens to Russian media. And that's an open question, whether a democratic state should proceed to restriction of information flows. Latvia and also other Baltic states have done it in the past. There have been temporary bans on broadcasting of Russian media, which was done as a reaction of what was seen as violation of, for example, Latvian media law, when they, because of basically what was understood as a hate speech that was channeled through the Russian state-funded media that were also broadcasted in Latvia. The question about the eventual dangers for the Baltic states from Russia are closely linked to some more global questions concerning Putin's long-term aims and geopolitical perceptions. So firstly, was the hybrid war in Ukraine an attempt to preserve Russian zone of influence or the first step in expanding it? And the second question, are the Baltic states still perceived in Moscow as its traditional zone of influence, despite their NATO membership? And these are open questions to which I have no answer, but I would be very interested to know what your opinions are on these questions, especially the perception of Ukraine. Was this an attempt to preserve Russian zone of influence or the first step in trying to expand it? The NATO and the US are the main security guarants of the Baltic states. In the context of the Ukrainian crisis, President Obama reassured the Baltic states that their NATO allies are standing by them. So in 2014, in September, when traveling to Europe, Obama visited Estonia and emphasized in his speech the continuous US and NATO commitment to the independence of the sovereignty, to the independence and the sovereignty of the Baltic states. So he made a very moving speech. I'm quoting, so if you ever ask again, who will come to help? You'll know the answer, the NATO alliance, including the armed forces of the United States of America. You lost your independence once before. With NATO, you will never lose it again. So of course, the speech was very well received in the Baltic states. And since the beginning of Ukrainian crisis, NATO and the US have actually increased its military presence. So in addition to already existing patrolling of Baltic airspace that has been done by NATO forces in the past, NATO member states have agreed to deploy their troops also on the ground in the Baltic countries. Currently, there are about 600 American soldiers in the Baltic states. But by the beginning of this summer, there are about 3,000 more NATO troops to arrive. And this time I insist on NATO troops, not just American, because so these are going to be multinational troops led by United Kingdom in Estonia, led by Canada in Latvia, and led by Germany in Lithuania. So some argue in the Baltic states that the tragic events in Ukraine, which were followed with big compassion in the Baltic states, that these events that took place in Ukraine actually have somehow contributed to the security of the Baltic states, because as one Latvian official recently told me, our allies have never done so much for our security as they are doing now. At the same time, everybody knows that these military, this increase of military presence in the Baltic states is still more symbolic than something that could really actually stop Russian aggression, if that would take place one day. The mood in the Baltics was rather optimistic until the election of President Trump. That provoked some uneasiness in the Baltic states. So while during his campaign, Trump questioned the strategic rationale of the US commitment to the Baltic security, he insisted that if Baltic states wanted to the US to participate in their defense, they should meet the NATO requirement and devote 2% of their GDP to the military budget. So their military budget. The president, then a candidate, was obviously not informed that Estonia already meets this requirement, and Latvia and Lithuania had set a goal to reach this 2% of their GDP for the military budget by 2018. The Baltic officials have avoided to criticize Trump. They have met with Mike Pence during his trip to Europe. And Pence, during this trip, so firstly, he reassured NATO allies in general that the US is still committed to the security of its European partners. And then, as I said, Pence met explicitly with the leaders of the Baltic states, insisting that the US is still committed to the security also of the Baltic states. So the Baltic states, I think in the coming months, the Baltic states will stick to this policy of avoiding any criticism regarding the US or the policies of Donald Trump. And the Baltic states will definitely continue their pro-Western policies. They are currently very much opposed to the European defense plans, because they see these European defense plans, basically the idea of a European Union building up to more a military union, as a way how the Europeans want to get the US out of Europe. And they consider the US presence in Europe as crucial for their national interest. The one thing that is going to be, but that can change. So if we really see that the US wants to limit their commitment to NATO, then the Baltic states regarding this question might eventually change, but that would be a huge policy change. What will not change is the commitment of the Baltic states to European Union and NATO. So there is no way that the Baltic states would voluntarily abandon their pro-Western policy. There are no serious political forces, neither on the left side nor on the right side, asking for this change. So, and even in the Baltic states, of course, there is a criticism of European Union. As everywhere in Europe, there are no political forces that would really, serious political forces, that would argue for Baltic states leaving the European Union. So the Baltic states will stay in European Union as long as it exists. So it is very hard to predict what's going to be Russian policy in the Baltics. The relations between the Baltic states and Russia since the beginning of Ukrainian crisis have been normal as they can be. Sorry. Baltic states strongly supported Ukraine during they made strong statements in the case of Latvia and Estonia. Lithuania actually was one of the only countries that provided some military help to Ukraine. But they are strong advocates, and they will remain strong advocates of maintaining the sanctions. Also, Latvia in 2015 was assumed the presidency of the EU, the rotating presidency, so it was kind of restricted in its capacity to make strong statements against Russian aggression in Ukraine. Surprisingly, as I said before, Russia has kept low profile in the Baltic states since the beginning of Ukrainian crisis, except the misinformation campaigns through the state-funded media that are broadcasted also in the Baltic states. But otherwise, relations between Russia and the Baltic states have been much calmer than they were in the 90s or even early 2000s. For example, today it's March 16, a day that for historical reasons that I will not explain now, but a day that for historical reasons is very sensitive for Latvian society. In the past, Russia has used this day for provocations, and today it was not the case. So there were internal tensions, but we didn't feel any external presence in what happened in Riga today. So what does this calm mean? The apparent calm in the relations between the Baltic states and Russia. So it's, of course, something that is open for interpretations. Again, I think everything depends on the answer to those two questions that I outlined before. Was the hybrid war in Ukraine an attempt to preserve Russian zone of influence, or was it a first step in expanding it? And also, how does President Putin perceive the Baltic states? Does he perceive them still as a traditional zone of influence, despite their NATO membership? And also, many, many things depend on the capacity of the US, but international community in general, to maintain sanctions in place until the Minsk agreements have been fully implemented, and stick to the non-recognition of the legal annexation of Crimea. Because this is not just a question about Ukrainian sovereignty or territorial integrity. This is also a question about a world order, the post-Cold War world order, that is based on certain principles and certain norms. And it has to be clear, and it has to be underlined by Europeans and by the US, that the violation of these norms and these rules have consequences. Thank you very much.
I've answered two questions, very pregnant and very to the point. I wonder if there isn't a third question. Given the events in this country over the past few months, and that question is, is it most useful to see these two areas of the near abroad as part of a regional Russian strategy, or would it be more important, if more frightening, to see them as part of a global strategy? You use the term hybrid conflict, and when we think about hybrid conflict, we think of all kinds of aggression, ranging from fake news on one extreme to actual invasion on the other extreme, with many variations, many permutations in between. If we think of these areas of the near abroad in terms of a global strategy, and we include Russia's strategy towards the United States in that global strategy, that raises a third question. Does the world still look the same as it did in 1989, that is divided between regional and global issues, or would it make the most sense to see the Russian strategy in global terms, in which case the moves against the United States over the past few years need to be seen in the same framework as Russian attitudes towards the Baltic states and towards Ukraine and towards other areas of what we used to call the nearer world? And if that's the case, the prospects are rather frightening for us, although they may be less frightening for the Baltic states in the short run. In other words, what's the interpretation we should give to the softening of Russian attitudes towards the Baltics? Is it because of short-term considerations, or is it because the Russians are now thinking in global strategic terms in which their attacks on the United States, and I don't use the word loosely, are being seen by the Russians in the same framework as their attitudes towards the nearer world?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that is an excellent question to which we might not have an answer yet. But I think that, like, and that's something that the Baltic states have insisted on a lot recently, that the strategy that we can see, for example, the cyber attacks against the DNC in the US, that's something that has been done in the past against Estonia or against Georgia during the war between Russia and Georgia. So we can see how practices that have been tested in the near abroad now are used on a more global scale. And yes, I would agree that maybe now Russian foreign policy has shifted towards not actually trying to gain territory in the near abroad, so basically expanding, getting back to the territorial territory that the Soviet Union had in the past. Now it's getting more global and much more sophisticated. What makes me doubt about this is the fact that they still annexed Crimea. So at the time when everybody thought that in Europe and nowadays nobody is fighting a war for territorial gains, it still happened. So that's why I'm very cautious about the interpretations that we might have about the grand strategy of Russian foreign policy. But as I said before, it's true that we can see the regional practices now being used in a more global scale.
Just a quick answers, excellent questions, and as always. I would agree. I mean, you had part of the answer in your question, of course. I would agree that Russia is a regional player, and what it did in Ukraine and what it's also doing in Moldova, in Georgia now, with actually moving much more into, for example, South Ossetia, into incorporating South Ossetian military in under Russian control and things like that. It has proven that it has a very intrusive and aggressive regional strategy, and it is not stopping. The stakes for Russia is high, and I think everyone is increasingly aware of the fact that Russia really cares to go quite far to maintain its influence in the region, whereas other players are not. But you're right. I mean, the linkage with the global strategy, I think the way we should reframe this question is because the world has changed. I mean, this distinction between the global and the regional is not really working anymore. And so this distinction is obsolete. And if we look at it from that perspective, I think the whole discussion of whether Russia is a global power or not has to be more understood as about being Russia being and having a power to disrupt and to spoil. I think that's the point of Russian influence globally, and that's where it's acting more opportunistically and it's more tactics than strategy, right? And so linking it back to the question of the liberal world order, I think the broader sort of rationale for Russia is just to show that it's an order that doesn't exist. It's an order that the West felt existed and dreamed it up in the immediate post-Cold War era, and Russia is not comfortable with that order. It wants to go back to the sort of great power balance, forget multilateral institutions. It wants to expose the weaknesses of the EU, basically. The EU is a fluke. The whole pretense of the EU is very self-celebratory, and it doesn't have a real sort of hardcore real political basis. I think this is the Russian rationale when we look more at it more from a global perspective.
Is that me?
Yeah, that's you first.
So publications like the New York Times and Washington Post have alleged recently that there is this rogue group of freelance diplomats, like semi-formal, like people like Paul Manafort and Andrei Artemyenko and people like that, who might be channeling some sort of a deal between the Trump White House and Russia about Ukraine. And my question is that a real thing? Is that really happening? And what would a deal like that look like?
I don't know more about it than I'm reading the same publications, but let me just link this back to my last comment. I think this is the risk of the politics of ambiguity. I mean, these kinds of back channel diplomacy and conspiracy theories and this kind of behind the scenes opportunism by various stakeholders to the conflict is going to go on inevitably until there is clarity about the direction of the US policy in that region. I think this is the real, and I mean, I'm pretty sure there's basis to some of this leaked information. I mean, we know that different stakeholders try to promote different kinds of solution to this, to the current conflict, and so I wouldn't question the plausibility of these facts that were made public, and we don't know. That's the problem. We don't know how high is the risk that some of this may catch the attention of the current administration at some point and may ring some bells, and who knows what it's going to be translated into. I mean, this is where the fragility and the kind of uncertainty of the domestic politics and the way this government is now being set up and all of that, this is how it has these huge geopolitical repercussions.
Do you think that the current Russian, I guess, foreign policy news or responses is more a part of a display of Russian dominance to kind of distract away from the issues of the economy? Or do you think it's hinting at more a sense of vulnerability to NATO encroachment that's happened in the previous years, and especially what happened in Georgia in 2008? So what comparing both those perspectives, what kind of philosophy would you side with?
I think these are both important factors, but yours is a great comment, because what people often overlook in this kind of big geopolitical chess game kind of narrative is the domestic drivers of foreign policy, which is sort of a basic, very basic argument, very well known. And it's huge for Russia, because it is the fact that Russia has been militarizing its society and has been making huge investment into its modernizing its military at the time when actually it should have been modernizing the rest of the society. There has been a huge economic downturn, which partly has to do with the sanctions, but with many more structural factors. So Russians are very well aware of the fact that even if the sanctions are lifted, it's not going to really resolve the issue for them. So absolutely, that's very important. The way this kind of war making and sort of generally aggressive foreign policy works for authoritarian regimes is very different from the way this works for democratic societies. And so obviously there's the whole question of regime preservation and sort of strengthening the leadership and so on and so forth. But that does not, one tiny footnote, which I think, let us just keep it on the margins of this discussion, which links to the comments about the Baltics. It's amazing how much the Crimean annexation is being accepted by the population on the former Soviet Union territory. It's somehow, even in the Baltics, I was surprised I didn't know this data, that overall it seemed like, well, you know, it kind of sort of makes sense. Crimea is a peculiar sort of part of the Soviet Union. It sort of makes sense that it's Russian. But the military conflict in Donbass, in the east of Ukraine, is not popular anywhere in the former Soviet Union, and it's not popular in Russia either. And I think this is one of the reasons why I believe there's not going to be a major military escalation and a major land grab on that front, because Russian population is not eager to see Putin to assert himself militarily in eastern Ukraine. So actually now we know that 2018, he has to face a new re-election, and it's going to be a really complex balancing act for him, because he is interested in sort of pumping the nationalist feeling and the kind of patriotism, but don't forget Russia is a multi-ethnic country, and Putin is not a big friend of real right wing in Russia. I mean, he has been trying to marginalize them. He doesn't want to give them too much space in terms of this sort of dominant discourse and too much visibility. So there are limits domestically. I'm glad you brought up those factors, that domestically it's a very complex issue as well for Russia.
Questions? Yes. I'm assuming that a necessary condition for Russia to be successful in invading or taking over eastern Ukraine or the Baltic states would be that a large part of the population supports that, right? Which is also a distinguishing factor between Crimea and eastern Ukraine. So therefore, wouldn't it be wise for Europe to invest more on an information campaign to counter the misinformation, to show, even if you're an ethnic Russian, the benefits of remaining a part of Europe rather than Russia? Just because it sounds that the Russian minority is oppressed in the Baltic states, they have lots of freedom, they can enjoy their culture, but economically speaking, it's much more beneficial for them to remain. Wouldn't that narrative be something that Europe should focus on more?
Yes, that's a great question. That's something that the European Union in general has now starting to consider how to act against, to counter the Russian misinformation campaign. But in the Baltic states also, this is a big and extremely important question. Estonians have now a Russian language channel by a public Russian language channel. Latvians have decided to have, we have since the independence, we have some Russian language content in Latvian, mainly Latvian language channels. And the problem is that the creation in Latvia of a Russian language TV channel is a bit complicated, because the Nationalist Party insists that if we do this, then Russians will not be motivated to learn Latvian. But the big problem is that the Russian TV channels, and it's not only in the Baltic states, in the whole post-Soviet space, they offer not only news, they offer TV stars, TV shows, music, etc., etc. The Baltic states, for example, they don't have funding, they don't have a possibility to have the same or similar TV shows or TV stars that are actually, this is a content, a cultural content that nobody else is really able to provide. We could hope that the Russian-speaking minorities would somehow shift and become less interested in Russian pop culture and start to be more interested in, let's say, Western European and American pop culture. But that's something that will take place in a longer period of time. It will be a generational shift. So this is the problem, that we are not just competing with the news content. We are also, if we want really people to stop watching the Russian TV channels, we also have to provide some kind of really interesting popular culture content.
Just very quickly, the EU, this is something I've been looking into, and the EU actually now has been investing a lot into that kind of assistance to the so-called Eastern Partnership countries. It has the EU Stratcom department, which is brand new, and kind of trying to do strategic communication European Union way, so it's very, again, very bureaucratic and slow and everything. But that there's a lot of awareness of this in the EU policy circles. Another thing that that happened, and I'm going to quote a couple of polling results now, is that many people said, okay, Russia got Crimea, but it lost Ukraine. The fact that, there was the, you know, this was a very blunt military invasion, and the fact that there's now an open military conflict going on has it alienated the Ukrainians enormously from Russia. So the polling shows that it has, on the average, Russia has a very negative image among Ukrainians. There's this rally around the flag effect. And so, for example, a few months before the crisis erupted in 2013, there were 38% of Ukrainians were pro-European integration, 37% were pro-Eurasian Economic Union integration. Now, the data from December 2016 shows 47% pro-EU and only 17% pro-further integration with Russia. So there has been a huge opinion shift already just because, again, of this sense of vulnerability and having been sort of invaded and having lost the territorial integrity at the hands of Russian aggressive behavior.
Yeah, so this goes along some of the previous questions, like what are the, in both Ukraine and in the Baltics, particularly in the Baltics after 1991, there was effort by, the new governments to distance themselves from Russians, right? And there were punitive policies regarding citizenship, and now there's, as the question indicates, there's some interest in by these governments to try to win over ethnic Russians there. So I wonder, what are they doing? Is your sense they're doing much about that in the Baltics, right? And in Ukraine, of course, there's that story which probably did have a big effect, that as soon as the Maidan, as soon as Yanukovych flees, or was it right before, the day after, right, they passed this law banning Russian as a official language, and then they rescinded that, but they seem not to be very sympathetic, not doing much to woo back any ethnic Russian support. So I wonder, are they doing that now? Or also, what are the discussions among the ethnic Baltic populations or the more pro-independence Ukrainians about should we try to get closer to these Russians or, let's go further towards alienating them and see what happens?
Thank you, that's also a very good question. And of course there have been, in my opinion, important mistakes that were made in terms of integration of Russian minority in early 90s. By the end of 90s, the states, they started to realize that they have to deal with the problem of the very important Russian minority. And over the 90s, these policies evaluated, also as the political elites gained some experience, because there were people who came to power in the early 90s who were completely inexperienced. They gained experience. They also, because of the pressures of the EU and to a certain extent NATO, but mostly EU, to get to become members of the EU, so there were policies that had to be implemented in terms of minority rights. But until this today, I think that it really much there is a big debate, as you said, among so-called ethnic Latvians or ethnic Estonians. As in every country, there are more conservative forces. There are more liberal forces. The liberals insist on more inclusive policies, in doing more in terms to making Latvian state more attractive in the case for the, so that in the case if Russian speakers have to choose, they would choose Latvia instead of Russia or Estonia instead of Russia. And I think they would. And I think that we can always do more. There can always be more integration. There can always be more openness in political space, more dialogue, etc., and so forth, and so on. But at this point, I think if those people were a choice would be proposed to them, they would choose the citizenship and of European Union and as the Estonian and Latvian. And I think that the accession to European Union has done a lot, because being a citizen of Latvia and being a citizen of Estonia might be let's say, more attractive than to be a citizen of Russian Federation, but it's even more attractive to be a citizen of European Union. And
Yeah, so we can see also that the soft power of EU.
Two questions, more specifically on the language. I think what has been amazing in the post-Maidan Ukraine is that there has been a wide-ranging, popular bottom-up attempt at depoliticizing language. So you're right about that. London with the, you know, banning Russian as a second language. It's almost like as if the political establishment kind of mishandled it a bit, but the bottom-up kind of civic response to this has been to depoliticize the language, and so the rally around the flag, in fact, that I referred to before, also included this movement towards saying, I'm a Russian-speaking Ukrainian, and there's, you know, even if half of my family is actually originally from Russia, never mind, I identify as a Ukrainian and I speak Russian, and there's no problem with that. And there were all these initiatives about people speaking Russian in Western Ukraine, which is and so on and so forth. So in terms of that was, I thought, a very powerful and an interesting civic response to that. Having said that, I think it's an extremely delicate balance now that goes to the heart of what kind of nation building project would actually gain traction in Ukraine. And this is not a resolved matter. It's a very delicate process that is still continuing. And the sense in the months after the Euromaidan was that the civic nation building was a kind of the predominant choice and the predominant narrative also politically. So the idea was is that we come together as a nation because we choose for a certain civic project based on certain civic values, accountability, transparency, pluralism, and so on and so forth. Now the problem is, that's not something you can sort of resolve once and for all and, you know, put a stone in it, so to say. As the situation is becoming more volatile, also politically, that obviously creates more space for more radical nationalist forces. It also opens the discussion towards more intolerant, exchanges. And so that I think in Ukraine, there's still a risk that the more ethnic-based nationalist discourses and visions for nation building might colonize or, you know, gain dominance in the public debate, and that is a big challenge. It's a big challenge to stick to that kind of original Euromaidan idea, which was really amazing because it had this strong civic aspiration behind it.
Okay, I'm going to wrap up the formal question period here. I say just formal because as we move in through the room to have some beverages and snacks, Katarina and Una would be happy to answer further questions and talk with you. One last thing, as I said at the beginning, you've got a little feedback form on your chair. Please fill it out. There's a box to receive that in the next room where the food and beverages are. And as we head over there, please join me in thanking our guests once more. For